The United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. Please be seated.
Good morning. This morning we will hear United States against Melson. This is a certified case. Counsel for the government, you may proceed.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Major Donna Rappel, and I, along with Colonel Gerald Bruce, represent the government in this matter. Two issues were certified by the Judge Advocate General of the Air Force for review by this court. The first one, whether the Air Force Court erred in finding ineffective assistance of counsel. And second, whether the Air Force Court erred in rejecting trial defense counsel's declaration as untimely. The basic facts of the case are as follows. At trial, the appellee entered mixed pleas to 7 charges and 10 specifications and was found guilty of all 7 charges and 9 specifications. Upon appeal to the Air Force Court, he presented 4 issues, including a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel for failure to request relief for pretrial punishment. Along with that, he submitted a declaration. When the United States responded to this claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, we relied upon the facts contained in the record of trial, where the appellee had the opportunity to raise the pretrial punishment claim and did not do so. For example, the appellee stated in his declaration that he never made any complaints about such treatment that he now complains. There was no motion made at trial. There was no mention in his unsworn statement. And when the military and judge inquired on the record about Article 13 punishment, the response from the defense was no.
Yeah, the response from the defense, the response according to the accused in this case, the response of his counsel.
Yes, Your Honor, that is
not of him. And according to the accused, his defense counsel told him that never asked him about what was going on, never listened to him, and didn't explain to him that there was anything that could be done.
That is the claim that the appellee makes in his declaration. That is correct, Your Honor.
However, right. And so what I would like to talk about first is issue number 2, because a lot of the stuff in your brief relies on an affidavit, which is not before this court and was not before the CCA. So why don't you explain to us first how it is that the CCA abused its discretion in refusing to accept an untimely submission, and second, how it is that we're supposed to look at that matter when it's not before us.
Yes, Your Honor.
Or I should say how we're supposed to, you know, consider the facts contained in it when it's not before us.
Your Honor, the bulk of the government's argument on the first issue actually does not rely upon the defense counsel's declaration before this court. But in response to your request, I will address the second issue first, and that is that based upon, and it essentially ties into the first issue too, but based upon the factors in United States versus Gin, it's the government's position that the Air Force Court, when they found that the appellee had met his burden in this case, should have sought additional facts and ordered affidavits from the Trial Defense Counsel. In line with this court's ruling in United States versus Kirkwarrick and Lewis, whereas this court stated that they will not compel trial defense counsel to justify their actions until a court of competent jurisdiction reviews the allegation of ineffectiveness.
What in either of those cases, counsel, keeps the government from requesting from trial defense counsel that they submit an affidavit?
There isn't anything that keeps us from requesting.
And what evidence do we have that you did request and were told no?
There is no evidence that that request was made or that that response was given. But that isn't what the law requires, and that isn't the purpose behind the law is to secure the sanctity of the attorney-client relationship, unless a court of competent jurisdiction determines that that needs to be pierced by an inquiry asking or ordering an affidavit for the trial defense counsel to respond to the allegations.
Did the government argue Gregoric and Lewis at the CCA and say that if the court were to make this initial finding, then it had to take these following steps?
In the initial submission to the Air Force Court, no, that was not the government's argument. The government's argument relied solely on the facts contained in the record and the argument that the allegations contained in the declaration provided by the appellee was simply did not rise to the level that's required by Strickland v. Washington. to overcome the burden. And therefore, the government's argument to the Air Force Court was that the appellee had not met his burden. And in looking at the record of trial in total, the court could make a determination based on Strickland v. Washington that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel.
Well, the government elected to do that. They elected not to submit any affidavit or anything like that. Now the government comes in after the CCA has decided the thing on a motion for reconsideration and attempts to submit this affidavit. And the CCA says no. Why should we be in the business of pulling the government's chestnuts out of the fire when it elected not to do so when it had the chance?
Well, Your Honor, it's the government's position that the government is not required to seek affidavits from...
The government is not required to. The government obviously made a tactical choice not to. Now they're here complaining that they weren't allowed to after the case was disposed of. What do you want us to do, and why should we do it?
Your Honor, based on prior practice of the Air Force Court, there were many similar cases with similar facts alleged where the government did not submit an affidavit. The Air Force Court then would order affidavits being submitted from the Trial Defense Counsel in the event they felt that the affidavit submitted by the appellee in this case rose to the level to meet the initial burden.
Okay, let's look at the flip side of that, Counsel. Can you stand here today and tell us that there are no cases or that it isn't just as common for the government when faced with an ineffective assistance of counsel claim to, as an initial matter, file a affidavit from the Trial Defense Counsel?
That is true, Your Honor. However, because the government is
how does that cut? I mean, you're arguing to us, or at least it seems to me from your brief, that the government was under no obligation to do that because based on Lewis, et cetera, the CCA had to order the defense counsel, the trial defense counsel, to provide this affidavit. But you and I both know that it is routine, if not 100% of the time, for the government to submit a trial defense counsel affidavit without any action by the CCA whatsoever.
Your Honor, the government would agree that it has become routine for the government to submit an affidavit. However, the government certainly does not submit affidavits 100% of the time.
I'm not suggesting that you do.
Anytime ineffective assistance of counsel is raised, it is the government's position that we assess the credibility as well as the complete record of trial, and based upon that, as well as based upon the ease and the ability to get a timely declaration, make the decision to submit that proactively. However, that is not the requirements that the law requires under the case of U.S. v. Lewis and Gregoric. In those cases, it's clear that the law requires for the court to go through an initial determination of the appellee's declaration as well as the facts contained in the record of trial.
Before they compel an affidavit, not before the government can ask for an affidavit.
That is correct, Your Honor.
I mean, counsel, this would be a different case if you came to us and said, or a different case for me, I should say, if you came here and said, you know, we asked the trial defense counsel for an affidavit, we asked the CCA to compel an affidavit, and they wouldn't, we finally got one, and then they wouldn't consider it. But that's not what we have here. We have, on the face of what we have the government decided, made a tactical decision that it did not need an affidavit. As it turned out, it was wrong. It then tried to submit an affidavit, and the CCA exercised its discretion and didn't accept it.
Well, obviously, the second issue is where the government would differ with that assertion, and that is that upon the issuing of the decision, the government has the rights under the rule to request a motion for reconsideration, and along with that motion for reconsideration, submit documents that are relevant to that motion for reconsideration and that the court should consider for purposes of reconsideration, and that's exactly what the government did in this case. They submitted a timely motion for reconsideration, and they submitted a motion to submit the declaration from trial defense counsel as required under the Rules of Practice and Procedure 23B.
And why was it error to deny that?
Well, the Air Force Court provided three reasons for their denial. The first one being...
Why was it error to deny it?
Well, it's the government's position that the reasons given by the Air Force Court for their denial are not justified under the rules or the law. Specifically, they gave three reasons for their rejection, the first one being that the government failed to oppose the initial appellee's submission of their declaration. However, under the rules of practice and procedure, there was no rule for which we could have opposed the appellee's submission of his declaration. It complied with Rule 23B as far as an unsworn declaration. It was submitted timely. There was no standing that the government would have to oppose such a submission. The second reason they cited was that the government's opportunity was forfeited. However, the government was not merely submitting a motion to submit document after the decision was rendered. The government was doing a motion to submit document in accordance with their motion for reconsideration that was submitted timely.
But, counsel, let me ask you this. When the whole thing that the CCA was deciding, right, was an issue related to an affidavit, and when Ginn, you know, is based in part on, is there one affidavit, are there two affidavits, are there facts in dispute, you know, why wouldn't the CCA have expected, if you were going to file an affidavit, for you to file it in the first instance when they were making a decision that turned in part on whether there was one affidavit or two?
Well, it's the government's position that the appellee's declaration was not specific enough, certainly, to
require. Well, I understand that you disagree. I understand that you disagree with the CCA's view of the appellant's declaration, but answer my question. Why is it unreasonable for the CCA to say, government, if you're going to submit declarations, submit them at the time when we're deciding the issue that turns on whether there are declarations?
I understand your question, Your Honor, and the government's position is that that is exactly what we were doing. We were submitting a motion to submit a document, the declaration from the Trial Defense Counsel, at the time that the Air Force Court needed it for purposes of our motion for reconsideration.
So you don't agree that it would have been helpful for the CCA in deciding the Ginn issue in the first instance to have the declaration at that point in time?
Well, certainly in hindsight, based upon their decision, it would have been more advantageous for the government to have submitted it prior to their decision. However, based on the case law in U.S. v. Gregoric and U.S. v. Lewis, the court is supposed to look at the appellee's declaration, look at the record in total, look at the government's response, and if they find that the appellee has met his initial burden, at that point, they are to compel or order additional fact-finding information. And that is, in fact, what the Air Force Court has done on numerous occasions, including very recently in time to when this brief was submitted by the government. So it's not unreasonable for the government in this situation to believe that the Air Force Court would order an affidavit if they found it necessary, if they found that the appellee had met his initial burden. And that is certainly the government's stance going into that initial submission to the Air Force Court. And that is what the Air Force Court had done in the very recent past. They had ordered declarations and affidavits from Trial Defense Counsel when they felt that the appellant had met his burden.
You also acknowledged that the government has submitted affidavits without any action by the CCA, right?
Certainly, but that is
and
not...
And so my question, I guess, for you is, you know, are you asking us to have a rule that the CCA must always, that the CCA needs to do the government's work for it and that it will be for the CCA to decide whether or not an affidavit should be required in every instance and that the government need do nothing?
Well, Your Honor, based on the case law from this court in United States versus Gregoric and United States versus Lewis, that is what the case law stands for, is that the sanctity of the attorney-client relationship is not for the government to pierce on every single claim of ineffective assistance of counsel.
Only when it decides it wants to.
No, only when the Air Force Court decides they need additional information.
Counsel, that's not a tenable argument because you've acknowledged to the court that it is not unroutine for the government to go out and get these affidavits and with total disregard for the quote-unquote sanctity of the attorney-client relationship. So you can't argue both ways.
Well, Your Honor, it's the government's position that because we are proactive in some cases, we should not be punished for now, because that is not the requirement for the law. And because the requirement under the law, because other counsel go out and seek affidavits in anticipation, does not mean that that is now the standard. That is not the standard under Strickland versus Washington. That's not the standard under United States versus Lewis or Gregoric. That's not the standard from the Supreme Court or this court. And so because the government goes proactive on cases does not mean they should be held to that burden or actually lower that burden to that level, because essentially by the Air Force Court's decision in this case, they have lowered the level for ineffective assistance of counsel claims as outlined by the Supreme Court in Strickland v. Washington.
How so?
Because
ineffective assistance of appellate counsel?
No, Your Honor. And ineffective assistance of counsel claims under the Air Force Court opinion has basically now found that any time an appellant or an appellee, as in this case, submits a declaration that is conclusory and speculative, if the government does not on their own submit an affidavit, boom, IAC. And that is not the law. The burden is much higher than that. And the Supreme Court has found that there is a strong presumption of competence for trial defense counsel and that the burden is extremely high. And that burden was not met in this case.
Well, if I may, I don't think that the CCA would agree with you that the affidavit was conclusory and speculative. I mean, isn't that the heart of your problem?
Well,
I mean, because you're saying that they changed the Strickland standard, and it appeared to me that from their opinion that they correctly set forth the Strickland standard, they correctly set forth the Ginn factors, and that they disagree with your characterization of the affidavit.
And, Your Honor, the government would agree that that is what the Air Force Court believes. However, that is why the government has certified this before this court, because we clearly think that the Air Force Court got it in this case. I can see my time is just about up.
Counsel, I have one question. That is, if following Strickland, if this case had proceeded in federal district court and the defense made the submission that it made, would it be the obligation of the magistrate or trial judge who was holding the collateral proceeding to give the government an opportunity to submit an affidavit? In the contrary, if have an evidentiary proceeding, if the trial judge determined that the submission by the defense was sufficient to raise the issue of ineffective assistance of counsel in the defense favor? That is, if we were in federal district court, what would happen in this situation?
Well, Your Honor, to be candid, in my answer, I would be guessing because I have not researched
the issue. Then there's no need to answer. Thank you. Counsel for the defense.
Chief Judge Efron, Honorable Judges, may it please the Court. I am Captain Griffin Dunham, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, I represent the appellee, Staff Sergeant Vinnie Melson. The burden is on us. So for Sergeant Melson to prevail on ineffective assistance of counsel claim, there has to be a showing on his part that Article 13 was violated during his pretrial confinement in a civilian confinement facility. To show that Article 13 violation, Sergeant Melson submitted a declaration to the Air Force Court alleging five basic conditions of his pretrial confinement that were in violation of the 8th Amendment or Article 13. Those were being, one, disparaging remarks by the security guards, two, humiliating or embarrassing behavior that he was subjected to when he had to wear prison stripes going back to Moody Air Force Base, extreme temperatures, lack of medical care, and lack of access to the courts. Now, all five of those have been addressed by appellate courts, to include the Supreme Court, and resolved in favor of the proposition that those do garner some time for those illegal conditions.
Let's go to our issue two. How do you distinguish Grigoruk and Lewis? On their face, they seem to say that the government's got a chance. The government proffered an affidavit that certainly appears on its face to answer those claims of ineffective assistance of Article 13 violations, ineffective assistance of counsel. They were not allowed to file it. Grigoruk and Lewis seem to say on their face that they can file it. How do you distinguish them?
Your Honor, first of all, the facts of Grigoruk are somewhat similar to the facts in this case, but the cases are fundamentally different.
How so?
In Grigoruk, you have the government winning at the CCA level. So when it comes up for appeal, and if I can take a step back, the awkward position of Grigoruk that it would put an appellant in comes up on a review level because what it would stand for the proposition of doing is allowing an appellant to essentially set forth the facts that are going to establish an ineffective assistance of counsel claim, and then allowing the government to then not respond, not oppose whatsoever, and instead allow the appellant's assertions to become part of the record. And then when it comes up to the CCA, they're then placed in the awkward position of having to say, government, I understand that you don't want to submit anything on your behalf. You're not opposing this. And your brief in opposition does not at all even address the issues that were raised in the affidavit. However, we are going to now serve as a United States advocate, put ourselves in the position of the government, and now require you to perfect your case for the sole purpose of trying to establish a factual case against an appellant. And that's where they have the impartiality, the neutrality.
How does that since a Court of Criminal Appeals under Article 66 has to find it sufficient in fact and law, how does its requiring an affidavit on a contested subject cut against its impartiality? It's got a statutory duty to do that.
Well, Your Honor, it has a statutory duty to make sure that the issues, the facts that are alleged and contained in the record of trial, are supported, and the law and the conviction, the findings, the sentence is supported by the record of trial. When the appellant sets forth an affidavit and puts it to the record, then the record is complete for Article 66 review purposes. They can then take it and then make a determination, like they did in this case, supporting their position by the third factor again, and actually render a decision.
They can, but can they not if they think the record needs fleshing out, require an affidavit?
No.
They cannot.
Not in a case such as ineffective assistance of counsel, when by doing so, they're actually substituting their own position.
Okay, so are you saying that Lewis was wrongly decided?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Lewis and Gregoric are both correctly decided, but within the context of the appellee winning at the CCA level, mm-hmm. Gregoric and Lewis now have to change. So at least Gregor cannot be extended to stand for the proposition that when either party wins at the CCA level, before issuing that opinion, the CCA has to get trial defense counsel affidavits. It only states that if the government wins...
Well, you're not saying that they have to. You're saying they're prohibited from. I understood
correct.
You to say that they could not.
Yes, Your Honor, and if I misspoke...
Okay.
The Gregor proposition is that if the government wins at the CCA level, then obviously the court can order trial defense counsel to produce an affidavit for the benefit of the appellant.
So your position is that in every case in which ineffective assistance of counsel is raised at the Court of Criminal Appeals, the government is obligated to get an affidavit from the defense counsel, which can be extremely burdensome, not simply for the government, but for the defense counsel as well, even if the government believes that the case can be resolved without such an affidavit.
No, Your Honor, that's not what...
Well, how else do they protect themselves in a situation like this?
There are a couple of... if I may address the first part of your question first, and that is that if the record on itself, on its face, can actually contradict the claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, they can actually not oppose it at all.
But they have no idea how the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to make that decision. That is, they have a view, but if they happen to be wrong in the defense view, that they have forfeited their opportunity to contest the matter with a defense counsel affidavit by relying on that particular view.
And that's exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay, is that what would happen in the federal district court? That if the government opposed a motion for collateral review based on ineffective assistance of counsel, that the government wouldn't have an opportunity to have fact-finding either by affidavit or an evidentiary proceeding simply because its initial position was that the defense filing was insufficient?
I believe if they wanted to stand on that position, that it was ineffective on its face, they run the risk of potentially losing if the court believes that whatever the defense has done on appeal is sufficient to sustain an IAC claim.
Yeah, can you cite any federal district court case or any federal case that would stand for the proposition that the government forfeits its right by making its initial filing on the grounds that the motion should be dismissed as it being inadequate on its face?
Your Honor, not right now, but okay. I will research the issue and provide supplemental authority.
Okay. Now, you look fairly fresh this morning, so you probably didn't stay up all night reading the Donato opinion, but how do you square your position with the position that this court took in Donato?
It was actually provided Donato on the way to this court this morning. It's actually very similar to Gregoric, and in the sense that from what I can read in the latter portion of the opinion is that the government won at the CCA level, but the CCA did not, they summarily granted against the appellant, didn't allow the government to get an affidavit, and then ruled in favor of the government.
Was there a denial of the opportunity to get an affidavit in that case, or was it simply that they ruled without requiring it?
Your Honor, I would like to go research that case further, but from my understanding of the reason I was able to accomplish this morning, it basically asserted that the CCA has to get trial defense counsel affidavits before they can rule against an appellant if he has put forth a prima facie case and the record doesn't contradict an IAC allegation. And if I may, Your Honor, get back to the last question I failed to answer the second part of it, and that's that the appellate government counsel, they run the risk whenever ineffective assistance of counsel is alleged. Do they either, one, just oppose it on its merits and state that the record by itself is sufficient to overcome or at least to destroy the appellant's assertions, or do they go and get a trial defense counsel affidavit to make sure that their case is properly perfected before the Court of Criminal Appeals? So to remedy and to avoid this situation from ever happening, as a matter of practice, the appellate government counsel or the trial defense counsel should provide an affidavit, for one, or two, there should be a motion to compel the production of an affidavit.
Why should we do that in the military justice system in particular, where we're providing free counsel on appeal and a free appeal in every case, in which the system itself has a tremendous incentive towards raising ineffective assistance of counsel claims where issues have not otherwise been raised at trial? We would be putting wouldn't we be putting a tremendous burden on the defense counsel community by having them be in a position that every time appellate defense counsel raises the issue of ineffective assistance, the government would then feel compelled to go out and get that affidavit, regardless of the government's view of the merits of the claim?
It may have a slight encumbrance, or it might be a slight burden on the—
Why shouldn't we simply require the Court of Criminal Appeals to make a determination as to whether there is sufficient grounds for making that request, making that view of the need for an affidavit, and then calling upon them to go ahead and give the government the opportunity to get it?
And, Your Honor, they can make that decision, but they can't do so when the government hasn't even tried to, one, oppose it, or two, assert that there's any contradiction.
Is your assertion that the government didn't oppose the ineffective assistance of counsel claim in this case?
Through proffer and argument only, Your Honor. But yes, my response is that they opposed it. However, again, makes it clear that if there's a factual allegation in the form of an affidavit submitted by an appellant, that the court can consider that affidavit only if it's not opposed by the government, and then render a decision based upon the uncontroverted facts as set forth by the appellant. So they run the risk, based on, again, they're placed on notice, that they run the risk of losing the case because they haven't contradicted the facts that have been set forward by the appellant.
Right. I understand your position. That is, your position is that the government should view this as a risk situation in every case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay,
and then
err
on the side of caution and get the affidavits if they believe that it is a close issue.
Counsel, would you agree that there's at least some tension between the language in Ginn as to the reliance that may be made upon affidavits by the CCA and the consequences of not having an opposing affidavit, and at least some of the language in Lewis and Gregoric?
Yes, Your Honor. And that's why Ginn, Gregoric, and Lewis, it's tough to reconcile them directly, but you have Lewis, which predates Ginn, and then Gregoric relies upon the quotation from Lewis. So after the 95 decision of Lewis, you have the 97 decision of Ginn, which leads us to believe that Ginn stood for a separate, independent aspect of the law that Lewis did not. So there is a difference in there, and that difference is that the cases of Gregoric, when the government wins, is fundamentally different than when the appellant wins at the CCA.
Do you happen to know, I see that the CCA in its order basically denied the government's request for reconsideration and denied the request to append a document, but that there was a portion where they said they considered the opportunity forfeited. This was for submitting an affidavit without a showing of good cause. Do you know if the government went back to the CCA and attempted to show good cause?
Your Honor, from my understanding of the record, there has been no additional filing after the CCA's denial of the motion for reconsideration, motion to attach.
Thank you.
to address the second issue in the case as to whether or not the Air Force Court erred in not accepting the post-opinion declaration and also the motion for reconsideration, although that actually isn't part of the decision, it did not err. First of all, the CCAs have this inherent power to be able to act within their discretion. The court is, this court is reluctant to promulgate rules regarding their decisions to reconsider or to, say, grant a motion or deny a motion for a hearing in bonk. And also they didn't err because the court did exactly what again allowed it to do. It is an untimely submission when such a submission as required by Ginn would have been due before that opinion is actually issued. So on the position that the Air Force Court took on whether or not that was timely, it is not an abuse of their discretion to believe that the rules for court should have put the government on notice that any timely filing on an affidavit that opposes the Sergeant Melson's affidavit would have had to have come before the decision was issued.
Counsel, do you have a view as to whether it would have been an abuse of discretion if the CCA had granted the request to file the affidavit?
Can you repeat the question?
Maybe? Yes. Do you have a view as to whether or not it would have been an abuse of discretion for the CCA to have made the opposite decision than what it did with respect to allowing the government to file an affidavit after it had issued its opinion? Would that have been permissible?
If the government made a motion to...
The same motion that it made here, right? We'd like you to reconsider this your decision, and we'd like to submit this affidavit. And if the CCA had said, we're not going to reconsider our... We will accept the affidavit, and we've reconsidered our decision and come out the same way. I mean, would that have been an abuse of discretion?
No, based upon their basis for denying the motion for reconsideration. If they would have accepted the motion, say, pre-opinion, then you have conflicting affidavits and it goes back. But I think they can accept the affidavit after the opinion and then still deny the motion for reconsideration based upon there not being a suitable basis under the Air Force Court Rule 419 for granting that reconsideration, such as overlooking a material matter of law. In this case, and the Joint Appendix points out, the motion for reconsideration was based upon the CCA overlooking a matter of law, not overlooking a matter of fact. So in this case, the Air Force Court could have said, you provided us with additional facts. However, your motion for reconsideration asks us if we overlooked a material matter of law. In this case, we did not. We applied again. The facts that you submitted through the motion to attach have no bearing on this case. On that, the appellee raised.
Thank you, counsel. Does the government have rebuttal?
First, counsel, I'd like to respond to Your Honor's question about the opinion that came out last night, DiNudo, and how that correlates to the case at hand. In that case, it was a writ appeal decision from the Court of Criminal Appeals, and the government actually submitted a motion to dismiss, and the court denied the appellant's petition, and so the government was never shown cause on response or given the opportunity to provide the affidavits. And in that decision, this court actually sent that back for additional fact-finding so that the government had the opportunity to submit affidavits. Obviously, in some ways, that case is similar, and in some ways, the case is very different than what we have here today. First, the government's position is that we did, under the third gen factor, actually contest the appellee's declaration and the facts that he submitted. As I argued previously, under the second gen factor, the government's position was that it was conclusory and speculatory. But under the third gen factor, the government did contest the facts contained in the appellee's declaration by pointing out various areas in the record of trial where they were contrary to what he was saying now, including his statement of satisfaction with his counsel, as well as the lack of challenge from the appellee himself when his defense counsel answered that there was no Article 13 pretrial punishment.
I think what the defense position is in light of that, defense brief can speak for itself, is when the government took that position in the case, Why aren't we in a situation where then we would expect a government to have a defense counsel affidavit? That is, what is the explanation in this case? Not as a general matter as to whether a defense counsel affidavit should be required in every case, but in this case, given the way it progressed at the CCA, why shouldn't the government have been expected to file an affidavit in this case?
Well, it's the government's position that based on the second, third, and fourth Jim factors, the appellee's declaration didn't rise to the level such that he met his initial burden under Strickland v. Washington. Because, because of what was actually contained in the rod as well as what was not contained in his declaration, as well as the state of the law under Gregoric, Lewis, and Durrell. And in Durrell, actually, this court said that in that case, the appellant made no complaint about his defense counsel in his post-trial submission to the convening authority, and such a failure to speak up at or after trial belies his assertions, and that's exactly what we have here as well. The standard for ineffective assistance of counsel, like the defense counsel said in the beginning of his argument, is the burden relies upon the defense. And so in this case, upon initial review by the government, it was the government's position that the appellant had not come close to meeting his initial burden.
So is it your view, and can you point to me where we would find this, that the government took the position before the CCA that the CCA should not accept as true the statements that were in the affidavit?
Well, that was in the government's initial brief as well as in the motion for reconsideration, where the government argued that at trial, he was satisfied with his counsel. At trial, the response was no, there was no illegal pretrial punishment. His client did complain of some similar things that were contained in his declaration, but his counsel's clemency also supported that. And so that in and of itself showed that the assertions in appellant's declaration may not be wholeheartedly true, and that in his declaration he stated that he told his counsel and she said there was nothing that could be done. But yet in clemency, counsel responded that, yeah, the civilian county jails are a much different facility, and pay attention to what appellant states in his clemency because he's giving you reasons why he should be awarded additional credit versus the one for one.
But so just in fairness to the accused, I mean, is there anything in the record from which we can discern how it is that he would know from that clemency submission that what he alleges, which is that he told his defense counsel and she said that there was nothing could be done, that he had reason to believe that that wasn't true at the time of trial when he was asked questions about his satisfaction with his counsel, etc.?
Well, I mean, it's the government's position that that statement is actually not true, so and that's based on the record itself. I mean, you have a record of trial wherein you have numerous instances where the appellee in this case could have said different things regarding his satisfaction with his counsel, could have said something different at the time that the military judge asked about Article 13 punishment, could have said something in his unsworn statement about the arduous aspect of his confinement, could have said more in his clemency response about how his counsel didn't represent him properly by not making an Article 13 motion. And it goes on and on. I mean, you have all of those instances, and it is not unreasonable for the government to believe that on the record you have four or five instances of the appellee not speaking up for himself, not making any sort of affirmative statement, and then you have a post-trial declaration whereas he makes these sweeping allegations. And that happens more times than not, and the government is not required to go out and get an affidavit in every single time that an appellee makes a sweeping declaration that is not supported by the record of trial. And in this case, it was not supported by the record of trial, and therefore, it was not the government's burden to produce an affidavit from trial defense counsel. And that is based on Gregoric and Lewis. So it's the government's position that even not considering the trial defense counsel's declaration, the Air Force Court erred in finding ineffective assistance of counsel in this case. Further, had the Air Force Court correctly found that the appellee met his initial burden, then the Air Force Court should have ordered trial defense counsel to explain their actions. Additionally, since this case is not necessarily traditional in that the government responded timely and promptly with a motion for reconsideration and gave the Air Force Court what it is that they wanted, and then the Air Force Court promptly denied that. So it's the government's position that the Air Force Court has erred in finding ineffective assistance of counsel and asked this court in a de novo review to review all of the evidence before it and find there was no ineffective assistance of counsel in this case, or in the alternative, send it back to the Air Force Court under the direction to consider the trial defense counsel's declaration.
One question, counsel. Do you agree or disagree with the CCA's conclusion that if appellee's claims were true, if the accused claims about the conditions of his confinement were true, that they rose to the level of an Article 13 violation?
The government's position is that they do not, and that's based on the state of the law at the time that he was in pretrial confinement.
So the CCA got that wrong also?
That is the government's position before this court.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be adjourned.
The court stays adjourned until further order of the court.